The conference room smelled like lemon disinfectant and printer toner, the kind of artificial clean that never actually feels clean. The blinds were half closed, cutting the afternoon sun into thin stripes across the table. My palms were damp, and I kept rubbing my thumb against the edge of my notepad like I could sand down my own nerves. On the screen, an HR document sat open with one line highlighted in gray. "Relationship disclosure is encouraged," it said. "Encouraged, optional, soft language." Then my phone vibrated once, face down beside my water bottle. No ringtone. Just that hard little buzz that felt like a warning shot. I didn't even need to look to know what it was. A screenshot. A message. Proof. My breathing went shallow in a way I hadn't felt since I was a kid, hiding in a house where adults were fighting. I stared at that single clause and realized the truth wasn't that disclosure was optional. The truth was that disclosure was optional until somebody decided it wasn't. The company liked to call itself modern, open plan office, radical transparency posters, quarterly town halls where leadership answered carefully filtered questions. They had a handbook full of progressive language and a culture deck full of smiling stock photos. If you asked them, they didn't do office politics. They did alignment. In reality, power still moved the way it always does. Quietly. Through access. Through who got looped in, who got credit, who got protected when something messy happened. I came in as a contractor first, brought on to stabilize a client portfolio that had started slipping. My job was to fix things without making anyone look bad. That was the unspoken assignment. I was good at it. I knew how to read tension in a room, how to say the right thing without saying too much. I knew how to keep my face calm while someone else tried to shift blame. That's why I got hired permanently. That's why I got invited to meetings that weren't on my calendar. That's why, within 6 months, I had a badge that opened doors most people didn't even know existed. He was one of those doors. Not literally. Not at first. He was a senior manager in operations, close to executive leadership, without being one of them. The kind of man who could make a decision and have it treated like policy, even if it wasn't written anywhere. He wasn't flashy. He didn't flirt like a movie villain. He did something worse. He listened. He noticed when I was tired. He noticed when I spoke and people talked over me. He noticed when I stayed late, when I skipped lunch, when I carried too much like it was normal. The first time he said my name in a meeting and then waited until everyone quieted, it felt like a gift. I told myself I was just grateful to be respected. I told myself it was mentorship. I told myself I'd earned his attention. That's the thing about workplace entanglements. They almost always start in a place that can be justified. He didn't make the first boundary crossing a dramatic moment. It was a slow turn of the dial. It began with private check-ins that didn't need to be private. Quick sync, he'd message. Walk with me, he'd say, already standing up. He'd choose hallways with fewer people. He'd choose times when the office was thin. He'd talk about work, then drift into personal details like it was accidental. He told me about his divorce like it was a scar he didn't like showing. He told me about the nights he couldn't sleep. He said he felt like nobody really saw how much he carried. I nodded, listening, thinking I was being kind, thinking I was being safe. Meanwhile, I was becoming useful to him in ways I hadn't named. There was also the clause. The company had a relationship policy, but it wasn't strict. It read like a compromise written by lawyers and softened by PR. It asked employees to disclose romantic relationships if there was a reporting line or a conflict of interest. It said disclosure was encouraged, not required, unless certain conditions applied. And those conditions were vague. They had designed it that way on purpose. Vague policies are flexible policies. Flexible policies are convenient for the people who benefit from flexibility. When I first read it, I remember thinking it was reasonable. Adults are adults. People meet at work. Things happen. The policy wasn't moralistic. It wasn't intrusive. It promised confidentiality. It promised discretion. We didn't disclose. At the beginning, there wasn't anything to disclose. Just closeness. Just time. Just a private familiarity that made my stomach tighten in a way I pretended not to notice. Then one night, after a long client escalation, we ended up in the parking garage together. The air was cold and smelled like exhaust. My heels clicked too loud. He walked beside me, not touching me, just close enough that I could feel the heat of his body. He asked if I ever felt lonely, even when surrounded by people. I laughed like it was a casual question. He looked at me like it wasn't. That was the first time I felt it for what it was. The pressure, the pull, the invitation. I should have stepped away. I should have drawn a clean boundary right then. But I didn't. I was tired. I was flattered. I was human. And I had convinced myself that because nothing explicit had happened yet, nothing dangerous was happening. The next day, he sent me an email that looked normal if someone skimmed it. One line in the middle read, "You don't have to do this alone." I stared at it too long, and I replied, "The relationship didn't announce itself as a relationship. It grew like mold, quiet, spreading, thriving in the parts nobody checks. It stayed hidden because it was supposed to. That was the agreement, spoken without being spoken. Keep it clean, keep it private, keep it controlled." And for a while, it worked. Until someone else noticed. Until someone else decided that optional disclosure looked a lot like a weapon. The first threat didn't sound like a threat. It arrived dressed as concern. It was a message from a coworker I barely spoke to. A woman in compliance named Sienna, sharp and polished, and always a little too calm. She'd been with the company longer than me, and she moved through the office like she belonged to the building itself. Her message was short. "Hey, can we talk for a minute? Just you and me." No context, no emojis, no warmth. I should have ignored it. I should have asked what it was about. Instead, I agreed, because I'm the kind of person who still believes direct conversations can solve things. We met in a small breakout room near the back, the kind with a high table and stools that make you feel like you're in a startup commercial. She closed the door gently behind her. She didn't sit. She said my name once, like she was testing how it tasted. Then she asked if I was happy at the company. I gave a cautious answer, something neutral, something safe. She nodded like she already knew. "I'm only asking," she said, "because I'd hate to see your work here get complicated." My spine went cold. I asked what she meant. She finally sat down, folding her hands like she was about to pray, and slid her phone across the table. "Screen up. A photo, not graphic, not pornographic, just unmistakable. A quick capture in the parking garage. The angle was bad, blurry, but you could see him, you could see me, you could see the closeness that wasn't supposed to exist. It was enough. I felt my mouth go dry. My tongue stuck to the roof of my mouth like paper. She watched me carefully, like she was studying a reaction rather than speaking to a person. "You know about the disclosure clause," she said, casual, almost bored. "I'm sure he mentioned it." My throat tightened. I asked how she got the photo. She shrugged. "People talk, people see things, cameras exist. You'd be surprised what's already captured before you realize you're being watched." I tried to breathe evenly. I tried to keep my face composed. The instinct to minimize rose in me like a reflex, to laugh it off, to make it smaller, but she didn't leave room for that. She told me disclosure was optional, technically. But she said the company took integrity seriously. She said conflicts of interest could be interpreted broadly. She said if leadership felt blindsided, they could act fast. Then she leaned forward slightly and lowered her voice. "I'm not saying I'm going to report anything," she said. "I'm saying I can keep it contained, if you want." My stomach turned, contained, like it was a spill on the carpet. I asked what she wanted. Sienna smiled just a little, not friendly, strategic. She told me she was applying for a director role that had been stalled for months. She told me she had the qualifications, but not the sponsor. She told me my proximity could help. She never used the word relationship. She never used his name. She didn't have to. She wanted an introduction. She wanted an endorsement. She wanted me to set up a casual conversation where he could see her value. She wanted me to lean on whatever influence I had, like my body was a networking event. I didn't answer right away. My mind raced through options, all of them bad. Deny it. Confront him. Go to HR first. Quit. Confess. Disclose. Every option had a cost. She let me sit in it. "This isn't personal," she said, as if that made it cleaner. "It's just business. And I think you'd rather keep this quiet than have it become a thing." I heard the unspoken part. "I think you'd rather protect him. Protect yourself. Protect your image. Because if it became a thing, I would be the thing." A woman involved with a senior manager, a contractor turned employee, a story people could reshape into whatever served them. I told her I needed time. She nodded like she'd expected that. She stood, opened the door, and paused. "One more thing," she said, turning back. "If you choose to disclose now, just remember, the clause says it's encouraged, but the company's interpretation changes depending on who's embarrassed." Then she left me alone in that room, staring at a blurry photo that suddenly held my entire career inside it. That night, I didn't sleep. I kept replaying every moment I'd rationalized, every late meeting, every quiet hallway, every time I'd told myself we were careful. I also realized something that made my skin prickle. Sienna wasn't the only one watching. She was just the first to speak. The threats escalated in the days that followed, not in volume, but in precision. Little reminders. A calendar invite from Sienna titled Quick Touchpoint that she canceled an hour before, just to prove she could disrupt my day. A Slack message asking if I'd thought about it, sent at 11:47 p.m. like a whisper in the dark. Then came the part that changed the temperature completely. She sent me a screenshot of the handbook clause, highlighted, underlined, and beneath it one line of text. "Optional means you decide, unless someone else decides for you." I felt sick. That was the point of no return moment. Not the photo. Not the request. The realization that my silence had created a hostage situation. I went to him the next morning. Not in a dramatic way. Not storming into his office. I asked for a private conversation like we always did, like that was normal. My voice sounded steady, even though my hands were shaking under the table. I told him someone had proof. His face changed, just slightly, like a mask tightening. He asked who. I told him. He exhaled slowly and said, "Okay. Just okay." I waited for anger, for reassurance, for something that sounded like protection. Instead, he leaned back and looked at me like I was a problem he needed to manage. "We can handle this," he said, "but you need to stay calm, and you need to do exactly what I say." My stomach dropped. I asked if we should disclose. He shook his head. "Not yet," he said. "Disclosure creates a record. A record creates obligations. Let me think. Let me think." Like my life was a chess piece, I asked what he wanted me to do. He told me to keep Sienna close, to find out what she knew, to give her enough to keep her quiet, to make it look like cooperation. I stared at him, realizing I was being recruited into my own containment. I said I didn't want to play games. His eyes hardened slightly. "This isn't a game," he said. "This is the real world. You think HR is going to protect you? You think they're going to protect me? They'll protect the company. And if we give them a problem, they'll solve it in the easiest way possible." The easiest way possible. I could already hear what that meant. He didn't say it outright, but I felt it. If it came down to me or him, it wouldn't be him. And that's when the relationship clause stopped being a policy and became a trap. Because now I wasn't just hiding a secret. I was holding leverage against myself. And so was everyone else. It didn't explode. It tightened. First, Sienna got what she wanted. Not officially. Not in writing. But suddenly she was invited to a meeting she hadn't been invited to before. Suddenly she was presenting on a project that had nothing to do with her. Suddenly I was asked to loop her in on things that felt above her pay grade. I did it because the alternative felt worse. Every time I forwarded an email, every time I put her on a call, I felt like I was paying with pieces of my dignity. I tried to tell myself it was temporary, that we'd outlast her, that if we just stayed quiet, it would pass. It didn't pass. Sienna's demands evolved. They always do. Leverage is a hungry thing. She wanted access. She wanted visibility. She wanted to be seen next to the right people. And every time I complied, she grew bolder, like she could smell the fear in me. Then she shifted. She stopped asking. She started directing. One afternoon, she sent me a meeting invite with him included, titled Operational Alignment. My heart hammered when I saw it. It was the kind of title that could mean anything. It was also the kind of title nobody would question. I messaged her asking what it was. She replied, "Just making sure we're all on the same page." Same page, as if she wasn't holding a knife under the table. The meeting happened. He showed up. He was polite, calm, professional. She performed competence like a stage act, and he responded with measured interest. When it ended, he didn't look at me. Later that night, he texted me. "Don't ever set up something like that again without telling me." I stared at the message, heat rising in my face. I reminded him that he'd told me to keep her close. His reply came fast. I said, keep her close, not give her power. That's when I understood what was happening. He didn't see Sienna as the threat. He saw me as the breach. Something in me snapped, quietly, not loud enough to hear, but enough to change my posture in the world. I decided to disclose, not to him, not as a joint decision. I decided to speak to HR on my own because I was done being managed like a liability. I booked a meeting with an HR business partner named Mallory, a woman with a soft voice and sharp eyes who always spoke like she was trying to calm a nervous animal. She offered water. She asked how I was doing. She smiled the way people smile when they're about to take notes. I told her I needed to disclose a relationship that might be considered a conflict of interest. I watched her face carefully. It didn't register surprise. Not real surprise. Just calculation. She asked who. I told her. Her expression stayed neutral, but something cooled in the room. She asked when it started. She asked if there was any coercion. She asked if there was a reporting line. She asked if anyone else knew. I told her about Sienna. I told her about the photo. I told her about the leverage. Mallory nodded slowly, pen moving across paper. When I finished, she thanked me for being proactive. She said the company appreciated integrity. She said they would look into it. I walked out of that office with my stomach in knots. But there was also a strange relief, like I had finally stopped holding my breath. The relief lasted 2 days. On the third day, my access to certain systems changed. Not removed entirely, just narrowed. Certain folders I'd always had were suddenly restricted. A recurring meeting I led was reassigned for bandwidth reasons. My manager's tone shifted subtly like he'd been given a script. Then he called me into his office. He closed the door. He didn't sit right away. He said HR had raised concerns about professional boundaries and distraction. He said there was an investigation, which meant they needed to limit my involvement in sensitive accounts. I asked if he was limiting his involvement too. He avoided my eyes. I understood. It wasn't symmetrical. It was never going to be symmetrical. I found out through whispers that he had already spoken to HR before I did. Not a disclosure, not formally, a heads up, a narrative. He framed it as a misunderstanding, a brief overlap, something that was already ending, something I had misread. And because he was senior, because he was valuable, because he was practiced at controlling stories, his version landed first. Mine landed as damage control. Sienna didn't disappear either. She became invisible again, which was worse. She had moved her pieces and didn't need to be in the spotlight anymore. A week later, she walked past my desk and leaned slightly closer, like she was sharing gossip. Disclosure was brave, she murmured. I hope it works out for you. Then she kept walking, heels clicking, calm as ever. I wanted to scream. Instead, I sat there and felt the old lesson settle deeper. Policies aren't protections, they're tools, and the person who knows how to use them best is rarely the person who needs protection. The investigation ended quietly. No announcements, no accountability meeting, just a vague email reminding employees about the importance of professional conduct and reporting conflicts of interest. He kept his job. His title didn't change. His access didn't change. My role, however, became smaller by the week. Fewer projects, less visibility, less trust. People treated me like I'd introduced risk into the environment, like I'd contaminated the culture by naming what was already happening. Eventually, I was offered a transition package, not framed as punishment, framed as an opportunity, a graceful exit, a way to move forward without disruption. I took it because I was exhausted, because fighting would have meant dragging my name through a process designed to wear me down, because I had bills and pride and a body that was tired of being tense all the time. On my last day, I walked out with a cardboard box and a polite smile that didn't reach my eyes. The lobby smelled like fresh paint. Someone was laughing near the elevators. The building looked the same as it always had, glass and light and corporate optimism. Outside, the air was colder than I expected. My breath came out in white bursts. I sat in my car and didn't start it right away. I thought about that clause, encouraged, optional, confidential. I thought about how quickly optional becomes mandatory when someone wants something from you. And I thought about the way threats don't always sound like threats. Sometimes they sound like policy. Sometimes they sound like concern. Sometimes they sound like a calm voice saying, "Do exactly what I say." I still work. I still show up. I still read rooms. But I don't trust soft language the way I used to, because I learned the hard way that in some places, disclosure isn't a choice you make. It's a switch someone else flips the moment your secret becomes useful.